For the week of July 7th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 454, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. Back in Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the multiverse, in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
I don't understand why you're in a multiverse, or really even what a multiverse is meant to
be. Well, in another alternate reality, we recorded episode 453, and people actually heard it. But somehow, yes, it got sucked up into a wormhole. I blame Stephen Hawking.
I don't know what happened. We went to all that trouble to produce a show that was, I think, about 3 or 4 days long.
Yeah, based it was on probably 80 was, minutes. I don't know how long was it.
Yeah, it was actually very good. It was like 80 minutes. Yeah.
Well, that's an easy guess. And it disappeared. Somehow you put it up. It did not appear on our website. It didn't populate onto iTunes and the Apple Podcasts. We're not yet on Spotify, though we will be soon, won't we, Sperling?
Yes, we will. I actually did research that last week, by the way.
Very good. So we'll get that up somehow so you can get that dated lost episode. It'll be one of those famed lost episodes that will come in our box set. So, there's a lost episode. Never got to listen to it. There it is. So that last week's episode you haven't heard yet, but what are we going to hear about on this week's episode?
Absolutely nothing.
What?
Yeah, nothing. It was the 4th of July. Nothing happened.
Nothing?
Not a thing. No. So this show is going to be like Seinfeld. Nothing. It's about nothing. This week, we've got our patented, unique look at the worldwide box office, big deal or big whoop, some obituaries, and literally, that's it. So we can make it under an hour or nine.
Or two.
So let's find out. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz. He's going to fill us in on not last weekend's box office. No, no. Last weekend's box office is just too small for Michael. He's going to do the entire week's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We've got links to ComScore and Box Office Mojo in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office, what's the other one? The Numbers, The Daily, everybody. We go everywhere that we can to track down what these movies are, where they come from, how much money they've made. This is a great week. That's a good example of why we look at the entire week's box office. People talking about the weekend, I'm putting that in quotes, box office, were talking about 6 days of box office from Spider-Man Far From Home. They were talking about 3 days of box office for Toy Story 4. And if they covered worldwide box office, well, okay, then they were including maybe 4 days for some films that opened up overseas, like The White Storm 2 in China. So it's a ridiculous mishmash. Who cares when a movie opened?
That said, mm-hmm. Just speaking of last weekend's box office, weekend. Worldwide, right, weekend, correct. I am only talking about the weekend box office. And I only want to say that because this number is kind of staggering. $331 million for Spider-Man Far From Home. Now, that was the weekend box office.
That's just Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
I believe so.
No, yes. That's, you're talking overseas.
That is overseas as well. Yes, that is combined. Yes.
Right. So, well, here's more staggering. Do you think that's staggering? Last week, Spider-Man Far From Home grossed $469 million. What do you think sounds more impressive? $331 or $469?
I've got another number that sounds even more impressive than both of those numbers.
What's that?
$580 million.
That's not most impressive because that's looking at the total box office over 2 weeks. It's total. We're looking at last week's box office. And you said, oh my God, it grossed $330. Actually, it grossed $470 million. That's a lot more money. Why ignore Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? It's ridiculous. Plus China, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, because it opened up 2 weeks earlier.
Well, you know, look, 331, 470. Hey, come on. It's not that far off. Think about it this way.
Of course it is. That's $138 million difference.
Well, that was my punchline. My punchline was, it may not sound like a lot.
It
because,
does.
You know,
it does
you're
sound
in the
like
hundreds,
a lot. If that's not a punchline, that's math.
All that's right. Literally $138 million during the week. That's not bad.
Yes. So that's why we are not discussing the weekend box office. We're not worrying about when a movie opened up, how long it's been opened up, where around the world. These movies are not competing against each other. They're competing against themselves. But last week, the number one movie around the world is Spider-Man Far From Home. It grossed $469 million. It opened a week ago, earlier, in the Middle Kingdom in China. It's now at $580 million worldwide. It's blowing past $600 million. It's going to be yet another film to gross $1 billion worldwide. And number two around the world is Toy Story 4. That grossed another $154 million last week. It's now at $650 million. That's doing great. It's going to probably get to at least $900 million. It's doing really well in a lot of countries. In Mexico, it's the highest grossing animated film of all time. I mention that because it passed Coco, a Mexican-themed animated film. So that makes that a little bit more impressive. But that's at $650 million. Spidey is about to lap it, baby. That sucker's blowing past it. And mind you, Toy Story 4 will probably get to at least $900 million. It too might get to $1 billion. We'll have to see what its legs are like once The Lion King opens up next weekend.
And number just so you know, I have not seen the movie yet, so it will definitely get to $1 billion.
Oh, you have not seen Toy Story 4? No. Did you see Spider-Man Far From Home?
I have not seen I've been traveling. I haven't seen any. Although, you know what I did see? Here's the interesting thing. So I'm on the plane, right? I did see on the plane that Chinese movie that was a not a knockoff, but kind of like the Dallas Buyers Club, Dying to Survive.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that. It was actually very, very good.
Oh, that's the Chinese film.
Yes. And I saw Get Her If You Can. It was a Spanish film. And Super Lorenzo, which was kind of a, I don't even know how to describe, a Spanish film that was kind of like a boy that was a superhero. It was kind of a comedy superhero movie, a spoof on Superman. But that said, what dawned on me, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, and I know I'm not the first person to mention this, is Dumbo was one of the films you could have watched. And I realized, wait, Dumbo was released earlier this year. Then we had Aladdin in May. And then we're going to have The Lion King. And then there was a trailer for Mulan on the plane.
And Maleficent as well, which is not strictly a remake of a classic Disney film. It's sort of a spinoff.
Right. But okay, so let's take Maleficent out of it. But that's four animated films turned into live action films in 1 year.
That's overkill.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, no doubt.
Spread it out, Disney. Spread it out.
Yeah, exactly. Don't make us hate you. Yeah, I mean, Aladdin and The Lion King, weeks apart.
I thought that was silly when I saw it mentioned in last year when I saw that release schedule. I thought, you know what? Just spread them out.
Disney would respond with $900 million for Aladdin, $1 billion for The Lion King. We just don't care. But
yeah,
they may be making a long-term mistake. It seems silly to say that, but I do fear that. And fear may not be the right word, but that is something I think they should keep an eye on. You know, just making people sick of the products that they depend on people loving for decades. They want you to go to see the rides of Aladdin. They want you to buy the merchandise. They want you to watch the spinoffs. They want you to revisit the classic animated film again and again. And so those evergreens, you know, don't make us hate them. Back to the box office. At number three around the world is Annabelle Comes Home. That grossed $70 million last week. It's at $135 million worldwide. And number four is a film I already referenced. It's a Chinese crime thriller. It's The White Storm 2, Drug Lords. Technically, I think this is a Hong Kong film. It's produced and starring Andy Lau. He's a former triad member who turns respectable, and he puts out a bounty on a drug lord because he hates drugs because his dad was addicted to drugs. And so that creates all sorts of havoc because he puts such a big bounty on the head of a drug lord that everybody's swarming to kill him and breaking the law to do it. That movie opened up. It made $62 million on its opening week, a great opening for a film that cost a reported $25 million to make.
Did anybody kill his dog? Because I know a guy who would handle that.
No, that would be. At number five around the world.
That was a John Wick reference. You do know that, right?
Yes. At number five around the world is Aladdin, the live action remake. That made another $47 million. It's past the $900 million mark. $921 million. It's made $47 million last weekend. It is going to be facing The Lion King soon, but that could get to $1 billion as well.
Which goes to show you that we don't know what we are talking about at all.
Yeah, we're making a very vague argument that they are hurting their brand and that the Aladdin brand, which, you know, they got it on Broadway, they got it at the theme parks, they got it in merchandise. We're saying, you know, a little bit of overkill here. Well, of course, it wouldn't matter if they'd made a good movie, but nobody seems to think it was that good, except the audience. And number six around the world is another hit film, The Secret Life of Pets 2. It made $39 million last week. It's at $262 million worldwide. Not a patch on the original, so this is a disappointment, but not financially. At number seven is Yesterday, the Beatles flick. That made another $32 million. It's at $57 million worldwide. That's a terrific, strong second week. It's going to run for weeks and weeks and months and months because this is a film that appeals to adults. I haven't seen it yet, but I will. And so that's got a long, good run ahead of it. And number eight is a disappointment, Men in Black International. It's the first disappointment on our charts. $25 million it made last week. It's at $245 million worldwide. And number nine is a controversial horror flick. Critics loved it. Audiences, not so much, but it's doing okay. Midsommar. It made $11 million on its opening week. It cost about $9 million to make. The closest to information I can get is Deadline Hollywood saying it cost less than $10 million. I'm like, does that mean $9 million? Does that mean $2 million? I'm assuming it's up there in the $8, $9 million range. This is from the director.
I think it made $9,999,000.
It's directed by the director of Hereditary. And that film, like this one, got very good reviews. It's 2 hours and 27 minutes long. And our friend Stephen Garrett thinks it's a masterpiece.
Really?
5 stars out of 5. He loved it. I had no interest in seeing it. I don't really want to see it, but maybe I will.
At 2 hours and 27 minutes, yikes. Okay.
Yeah, I don't care about the running time if it's good, but that is an unusual length for a horror flick. But again, it's an arty horror flick. At number 10, another successful hit, Spirited Away, Hayao Miyazaki's film, finally opened up in China. It's a beautiful thing to see. It grossed $11 million last week. It's $92 million total from China alone. Worldwide, all of its issues and reissues put up together, that's now at $367 million. That is by far the best film on this list. It's a masterpiece. It's a great, great film. If you've never seen it, check it out. At number 11, now we do this worldwide box office. I feel like we're finding more information and more interesting stuff to say. We've been trying to sort of shorten our rundown of the flicks, but I keep finding fun stuff to say. Here's Avengers Endgame. It made another $11 million. It's at $2,772 million, I think. I think I have that number right. And it's at it needs about $16 million to match or pass Avatar as the highest grossing film of all time, unadjusted for inflation. So that movie's getting there. It's down to just needing another $16 million. They reissued it with some extra footage. It's going to get there, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So John Wick 3 passed the $300 million mark. That's now at $311. Rocket Man is at $175 million. That's doing great. Child's Play, another flick that is a modest success story. Not a great reboot. Whether they'll do a second one in this new version, I don't know. But it cost about $10 million to make. It made $6 million this week, and it's at $35 million worldwide. But I should say, where is it in the country count? It's playing in 19 countries, so it has a long ways to go. It has a number of countries it could still play in, so that could become a much bigger success story when all is said and done. That's certainly the case for the Korean flick Parasite. The Palme d'Or winner has made $81 million, mostly in that country. I'm certainly looking forward to seeing that. And we have a few new flicks at the bottom of our list. Pigman, Happy Pig Year 3. I think it's a Chinese film, but I can't swear to it. There was a Pigman, which is a smaller film from a smaller country, but this doesn't seem related to that. But I couldn't find two other movies in a Pigman franchise. It made $3 million last week, but if you know what's going on with this movie, if you can tell us how much it cost and what it's about, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. So if you know a film also that grossed more than $1.6 million worldwide last week, let us know, because it should have been on our charts. That's where you'll find the French flick Ibiza. That's a French comedy about a family vacationing in that holiday spot. And it's about a stuck-up podiatrist and his blended family. I don't know how you can be a podiatrist and stuck-up, but there you go. And in Japan, the film Diner opened up. $1.6 million on its opening week. No, it's not a remake of the Barry Levinson gem. It's a drama, or a thriller, I think, about a waitress who works at a diner that caters to criminals. It's directed by a woman, Mika Ninagawa, and it stars another woman, Tatsuya Fujiwara, And I think this is a case where it's very dangerous to work there. This is a place where the customer is always right because they have a gun.
You know what? I see a remake.
perhaps. I don't know if it's good or what the arc is of the storyline, but it sounds interesting. As a side note, you've told me this before. China, we know, has about 60,000 screens now. That's screens, not hard tops, but actual screens, I assume.
Correct.
How many screens do we have in North America?
I'd have to go to the MPA or NATO theatrical statistics, but it's usually around the 40,000 mark.
Oh, so it's around 40.
So yeah, they have passed
50% more screens than we have. Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of screens, and they need a lot of content. That's why Hollywood movies are getting pushed in there more and more. I mean, this is the season, big summer season in China, and the biggest movies are Spider-Man: Far From Home, Toy Story 4, and Spirited Away. They are not the Chinese flicks that should have played.
It's funny that you should ask that question, by the way, Michael, because July is the month that they actually, the NATO, National Association of Theater Owners, mm-hmm. will be publishing their update to that.
Oh, terrific.
And last July, 2018, they had 40,837 screens in North America.
How many?
Sorry, in the United States.
How many?
40,837.
They don't include Canada.
You know what? It does not look like they are.
Oh, isn't that interesting? I mean, it's North America.
Why.
It's NATO, right? American theater owners. That's bizarre.
Well, and I wonder if that's, in other words, I wonder if that's a mislabeling of the data and they actually did include, Canada.
It is like the 51st state, isn't it?
Yeah,
my mom comes from Canada. Four of my siblings were born there. By the way, people are looking at the box office. Hey, this season, the spring season, it's doing good. It's on par with last year, pretty much. We got lots of hits. Maybe the year isn't a disaster. Let's keep in mind, 2019 is the second highest grossing year of all time in North America to date. So when you're looking at the all-time list, we're number two right now. So it's the second biggest year of all time. If that's where they end up at the end of the year, that should be great. However, they are down 8% compared to last year because that was the biggest year of all time, but it's bigger than any other year. So just keep that in mind. A year that is not the biggest year of all time does not constitute a flop or a failure. And zeroing in down a little bit more on North American box office, a lot of documentaries are doing well. Ron Howard's doc on opera singer Luciano Pavarotti, that passes the $3 million mark. Echo in the Canyon, a music doc on Laurel Canyon, one of my great passions when it comes to popular music, that's at the $2 million mark. The Biggest Little Farm documentary, that looks like it might hit $4 million. And just opened up this week is a documentary on Leonard Cohen, which opened up to pretty good numbers.
Well, you mentioned China, right?
About
the number of screens. Patrick Vansikovsky, now I can say this, not only my colleague over at Celluloid Junkie, but also a former guest. Yeah, former guest, a guest on our show a couple of weeks back. He did a takedown, an analysis of PricewaterhouseCoopers analysis that the Chinese box office would surpass the U.S. or North American.
Did they
American
say this year
office.
Or something crazy?
I think it was this year or 2020 or
right,
something
at that
like that.
At that stage, you should, after seeing last year where both box offices rose almost the same amount, China grew a little bit faster, but they've got a long ways to go at this stage.
And that's exactly what he's pointing. He basically says, hey, remember in 2016 when you said PricewaterhouseCoopers, remember when you said, hey, it was already going to be the number one movie market in the world? Yeah, let's rethink some of that. It's a very good analysis, I thought.
Let's put a link in our show notes, and I'd love to check that out. I feel like the people, and not to pick on this person, Pricewaterhouse, but over the years, when I see those analyses of the entertainment biz coming from companies that aren't in the business, they seem pretty poor. They seem to really like, oh, today I got to pay attention to this business, though I don't know much about it. I mean, I assume it's their regular beat. But they often don't seem to understand how the business works or the context or the numbers. And again, I read stuff and go, really? Maybe they just have stock they want to push and this is their one way of doing it. I don't know. I think it's when they get it wrong, that makes investors invest poorly and that ends up being a big deal. It's a big problem.
Well, you said problem, but you also said the word big and you also said the word deal.
Did I?
If I put those in order, it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment. Our weekly segment, that is, where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Do you see how we skipped most of the other stories of the week? Do you see
none.
How we did
there
that?
Were none.
Exactly. So that's why this episode is going to be so short. Well, our first story, Rolling Stone, has officially launched its music charts, and the exciting result was really not so exciting, actually. You needed a microscope to see how it differed from the Billboard charts. Old Town Road, guess what? It was the big single. The new album by the Raconteurs was the number one album. But wait! That was a few days ago, actually. While the Billboard charts update once a week, the Rolling Stone charts update all the time, much like Amazon's book charts. So on Sunday, Rolling Stone has already declared Chris Brown's new album, Indigo, the number one album in the country. Billboard will probably say the same on Monday, but will Rolling Stone, being up to the minute, give it an edge? If not, it's hard to see how it will distinguish itself, at least at this early stage. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. There are two charts. It's going to take a long time before anybody supplants Billboard as the defining metric for the entertainment biz, music biz in particular. It's not going to happen, probably. Rolling Stone will have to establish itself. But hey, you know what it is? It's Monday. It's 2:30 in the afternoon Eastern time. I'm clicking on the Billboard chart, the top 200 albums, and it still has last week's chart up there. And will that make them feel stodgy? You know, the people going there are the industry people, but if they want to know what's happening today or this week or this hour, maybe they're going to flip back to Rolling Stone a little bit more to see what's popping up on the singles chart.
But it can happen. Don't laugh.
Yeah, yeah, it can happen. So it's something to think about. I think if Rolling Stone wants to distinguish themselves, give us, if they can get the information, give us a chart about streaming of albums, meaning album streams, meaning they've listened to 70% of the album. You know, that would be telling us something. How many times last week did people listen to the Raconteurs' new album, meaning at least 70% of it? That would be a stat that we can't get anywhere else.
Broadway legend Stephen Sondheim turns 90 next year. That's it. Next story. Just kidding.
Big deal. Big deal.
He turns 90 next year. Well, it is proving to be a very good time for him, not because of the natural desire to look back on all he's done, but to look ahead at all that's happening. First, the praise. Producer Cameron McIntosh is renaming the London Theatre home of Les Miserables to the Stephen Sondheim. That's what it's going to be called, the Stephen Sondheim Theatre. That makes him that makes Sondheim, the composer, the only living artist to have theaters named after him in both the West End and Broadway. Next, two big new productions of West Side Story are in the works. Director Steven Spielberg is making a feature film, which comes out at Christmas in 2020. Before that, director Ivan Van Hove revives it on Broadway starting in December of this year and opening a few weeks before Sondheim's birthday in March of 2020. And as an amusing side note, many are familiar with trimmed-down shows created for kids, such as Beauty and the Beast Jr. Turns out folk are also experimenting with the opposite, creating shows ideal for older people to tackle. Up first, Into the Woods Senior. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just success for one of the great composers of all time. And I forgot, there's a revival of Sunday in the Park with George coming to London with Jake Gyllenhaal, which he did on Broadway. I would fly to London to see that again. That's how great that was. So if you're in London, make sure you book a ticket right away. I think tickets are already on sale. And there was a Sondheim musical based on two Buñuel films. They were talking about that in 2016, 2017. They were sort of actively working on that. That seems to have fallen by the wayside. His last original work was Roadshow in 2008. But, you know, what a great career and how great to see all your work coming back again and again and great, fresh, new revivals.
So just if you really want to see that whole Sunday in the Park
Jake
with
Gyllenhaal?
George, yeah, you're going to have to do it. Actually, it's June 2020. To September 2020.
Yeah, so you really want to jump fast. And I should say, I really do think the senior thing is very interesting. For years now, you see like Aladdin Jr., Annie Jr., Beauty and the Beast Jr., junior versions of shows that are sort of kid-friendly, but done with like maybe there's a little material that's not appropriate, or they just make it tighter, 90 minutes. It's they make the staging simpler. They make everything easier for you to do at like a grade school or a middle school thing, or in community theater. So it's just easier to do and easier for kids to watch. Doing that with seniors and senior centers, that's kind of really cool. We're linked to a story in the New York Times about that. That could be a very profitable, interesting, smart thing to do. Getting older people who are retired to, you know, it's an activity, it's fun, getting people to go see it. I think it's a great thing all around, and it could become a serious profit center.
Speaking of profit and profit centers, the U.S. women won the World Cup for the second time in a
Woo-hoo!
Row. Yes, the ratings were also a triumph, with the women scoring a bigger audience than the men's final in 2018. Despite airing at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on the East Coast, and by the way, it aired 8 a.m. Eastern,
that's how 8 a.m.
Pacific. Yeah, that's kind of how the clock works there, by the way. It's going to be the fourth highest rated final of all time in the United States. While the Netherlands lost, they too won the ratings. 88% of all households in Holland were watching. That's unbelievable. The women dominated social media, with even their end zone performances coming in for analysis. Yes, soccer is really and truly popular in the U.S., and women can be an even bigger draw than men, especially when they keep winning. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. We also see some very smart entrepreneurs, like in Atlanta, they have a soccer team, a football team, and they built their stadium and said, we're going to have really inexpensive sodas and hot dogs. We're going to pack the stadiums. We're going to have fans buying merchandise. We're going to have the game look a lot of fun. That's making that team really valuable because people watch it now on TV. It's got a fun crowd when you go, and that helps power the team long term. Not so they can then raise the prices, but just so it's cheap, it's inexpensive, and it becomes a viable alternative. So they're packing them in at the stadiums that are smart about how they market it. They are reaching them at least every few years when they have a big event on TV. Soccer, as a passionate sport for adults, is really, really coming into its own. And, you know, I hate those end zone dances. I hate it in football. I hate it, you know, you score, you whatever, move on. I don't want to see you strutting your stuff. I really don't like it when the men do it. I don't like it when the women do it. But you know what? The overreaction to what they did was absurd. It's so sexist because the men do it constantly. And the women do it once and like, oh, how dare you? So, you know, it's a bit much. But I love Megan Rapinoe's quote. She won. And she referenced the late Nipsey Hussle, who just died a few weeks ago, and said, I just respected the game. Very cool.
Well, you know, I was in Portugal for most of the World Cup, or at least the knockout rounds. And I can tell you that Portugal, as you know, a big football country. They have not one, not two, but three different newspapers dedicated to football. Okay, that's literally how into football they are. And you could not find the Women's World Cup on any of the broadcast networks at all.
Oh.
Like I had to go to a sports bar in Lisbon to see this game. And I guess anybody that wanted to watch this game needed to go to the sports bar. It was packed. And I mean packed. You could not get into this thing if you did not show up on time because it was the only place you could see the game.
Interesting. Well, you know, it's not, you know, a Women's World Cup final. It's, you know, while football.
Not a final. Oh, this was like, well, you know, England versus the U.S.
Right. Well, that happens a lot of parts of the world. If it's not your country, you tend to have to go to a sports bar because they're not carrying, you know, France's
I guarantee you if it was Germany versus the Netherlands, a World Cup.
For women's? Women's?
No. Men.
Right.
It wouldn't matter whether it was the final or not, or whether Portugal was in it or not.
Well, that's European though. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's true. Women have miles to go all over the world, not just in the U.S.
Still, I do think the women's soccer team needs to be paid properly.
Oh, of course.
That's another story. No, I just have to ask this.
Oh, and
this
as
one
an
question.
Aside, the Times, the New Yorker had a great story about tennis and how poorly they market women's tennis, and they always make it secondary to men, which is absurd because they often have equally big or bigger stars. You know, there's no telling. And they really do a poor job of the Grand Slams marketing the fact that it's one of the rare sports in the world, perhaps the only one, where women and men compete together at the same time, at the same venue for the big prizes. You know, that's a very cool, unusual thing. And it was pegged to a doubles match with Andy Murray and Serena Williams partnered together, which was a really great match and probably the best match of the day. So lost opportunities that way.
Well, you know, you could, you know, not to belabor this point. Look, we're going to try and turn this into a 3-hour podcast.
We can do it.
Yeah. But I remember when Wayne Gretzky was playing in the NHL, mm-hmm. and the NHL was faulted by marketers for saying, look, you have the equivalent of Michael Jordan playing right now. He is one of the greatest athletes of all time, and you're not capitalizing on it.
How were they failing to capitalize on him? What were they not doing?
Just by marketing him, you know, and marketing.
You know, he seemed pretty marketed, but I perhaps they know more than me. But hockey's day had passed, but whatever.
Well, look, you know, my only question is, what, me worry? Well, me should worry. The catchphrase from Mad Magazine, by the way, which is what you just heard, is already a relic of the past. Speaking of, you know, you said hockey's time had come and gone. Mm-hmm. Well, Mad Magazine may be the same. Indeed, when President Trump tried to mock Mayor Pete Buttigieg as Alfred E. Newman, Mayor Pete admitted he had to Google the reference to see what Trump was talking about. Ouch. That slaps Trump as old, and Mad Magazine kind of is irrelevant in one offhanded comment. Well, Mayor Pete was onto something. Only a few weeks later, the venerable satirical magazine, beloved by middle school students everywhere, is all but dead. They're not going to publish any new material, and future editions of the magazine will be limited to reprints of old gags along with new covers. I guess spoofs of Charlie's Angels and Beverly Hills 90210 will always be relevant as long as Hollywood keeps recycling old ideas. And guess what? You know what? You could put those jokes in a magazine today, and it's kind of the same thing. Yep. But it's the end of an era. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It feels like a big whoop because I haven't thought about magazine in a long time. I didn't really read it much when I was a kid. I guess I did a little bit. It's the world of sixth graders, but I haven't felt like it's been in this even the sixth grade zeitgeist for a long time. So, you know, it's the fading away of something that probably passed out of importance a long time ago.
Well, what they really needed to do was spoofs of Fortnite.
Well, I'm sure they did when they still paid writers, but they just can't afford that anymore.
MoviePass
won't admit it's dead.
Yes, it won't admit it's dead. Apparently, it still tries to pretend it's in business, even though the service has made it nigh on impossible for people to use it for months now. The company announced it needed to go dark for weeks to update its app. They admit there's no good time to do that, but insist the height of the summer movie-going season is actually a pretty good choice, at least for them. When it returns, you can expect the usual option to see any new movie you want, anytime, except only at an inconvenient showtime during the middle of the week. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And can we move on to the next question? Because let's face it, we all know it's kind of a big whoop.
It is a big whoop. Thanks to our reader, Ron Fisher, who sent that in to us via email. I had not been aware that they were even still in business. I kind of thought they were gone. And so I was a little surprised to know they were still pretending they're in business. But I did love the AV Club headline. MoviePass sent a nice farm upstate with app updates. Lots of room to run.
That is a good headline. Yeah. Now, the battle between paid music streaming services continues to heat up. Apple Music just announced its latest figures. The service now has 60 million paid subscribers worldwide. That leaves them well behind Spotify, which has 100 million paid subscribers and plenty more who listen for free with ads and might be cajoled to pay up sometime in the future. So while Apple has a way to go, its growth rate is a lot steeper. Apple isn't exactly breathing down Spotify's neck, but it is at least visible in the rearview mirror. By the way, when you are visible in the rearview mirror, I think sometimes those objects look closer than they appear.
Exactly. Yeah.
Hey, maybe a driving metaphor is strained, but isn't that where a lot of people listen to their music services anyway? Come on. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I think we're keeping it in the proper context. That's just like when you're talking about China. When will they pass the U.S.? We think it will happen eventually, given the massive differential in population and assuming no massive collapse in the economy. You know, that's what could happen. Here, we see the same thing. Apple's got a lot of built-in advantages. They've caught up very quickly, built up a tons of subscribers, 60 million. But if they are going to pass Spotify, they've still got quite a ways to go. So it's certainly, they're a viable, huge competitor, but they're not going to pass them in the next year or two. So, you know, catch your breath.
In one of those movies I was telling you about that I watched on the long trip from Lisbon to Los Angeles was, I think, Get Her If You Can, I think it was the name of it. It was a Spanish film, and Spotify was used as a punchline. It was...
Dios mío.
It was a story about two billionaire brother sister who, the brother pays some woman to try and seduce his sister.
Oh, I know this movie, yeah.
So that he could get win a bet.
Right, we talked about this on our show. It was in our worldwide box office roundup 1 week.
Yeah, and he throws a party for this woman, and the woman invites the sister over, and the woman is, of course, not exactly a billionaire, and all of a sudden there was a Spotify ad, and the brother says, is that a Spotify ad? You don't even have Spotify Premium? He's it's just like, just to show like how rich he was, he had Spotify Premium.
He should have said, Spotify has ads? Like, you didn't even know it was possible.
He's like, well, the bigger punchline was, of course I have Spotify Premium. I invested in the company. Okay, well, just days after Lionsgate opened an indoor theme park attraction based on its properties, the company announced it would not be opening a similar attraction in Times Square.
Yeah, the original one, I think, was actually a preview in China. It got press, but I guess its official opening happens not yet. But there was a press event for that Chinese Lionsgate attraction.
Well, that means tourists won't be able to flock to New York City to grab a drink at a Mad Men themed bar. That, which, by the way, that does sound like a good idea. Or get a muffin at a Hunger Games style bakery, or buy Lionsgate themed merchandise like a John Wick lunchbox, perhaps. I don't think that one is a good idea. I don't think you should give that to your children and then make them wonder what they're missing with John Wick because it's a violent movie. Just saying. Nor will people be able to get on rides inspired by Divergent, the flop film trilogy, or a Hunger Games simulator, or a John Wick ride that includes shooting, of course. However, those ideas are good enough for the rest of the world. Las Vegas has a Saw-themed escape room. Dubai has a Lionsgate area at a larger theme park. China has their vertical theme park, whatever that means. I guess it, you know, we assume it means it's like a mall. And South Korea is getting something in 2020. We're not sure what. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I mean, it was a bad idea to bring it to Times Square. They do not have the intellectual property worthy of a whole theme park devoted to them. Most of these rides don't even sound like good ideas on their own. You know, you think a Mad Men themed bar? Well, I suppose if you've got a space and you got a bar, but it's a bit of a stretch. But, you know, like the escape room in Vegas, that's a very low cost little thing. You know, you tweak it out and it's, well, people have escape rooms and you say, hey, let's do one with Saw. That makes sense in terms of extending your brand. Most of the others sound like a real stretch. Lionsgate just does not have the ability to have a whole theme park devoted to its properties. I mean, a Divergent ride? People have already forgotten Divergent existed.
You know what would be funny is if in that escape room they like paired you with like, oh, you know, we have to send you into the escape room with, I guess we'll just put like two groups together. And one of the groups was a shill and like people started disappearing from that group.
Well, you know, they're remaking they're relaunching the Saw franchise. I think Chris Rock is involved. Good Lord. True. It's true. Yeah.
Oh, Hollywood. What can we do?
Well, bad ideas will never die. Not in Hollywood.
Hey, you said die, which means it must be time for Inside Baseball. No, just kidding. We don't have Inside Baseball this week because nothing actually happened. But we do have some sad news about some people who aren't with us anymore, like Ben Barinholtz, who died at the age of 83.
Had you heard of him? I've never heard of him.
I actually had heard of him, being a New Yorker.
Yeah, well, I lived in New York. I live in New York for many years. But yeah, he's an innovator of midnight movies. He also became a film distributor. He ran the Elgin Theater in Chelsea in New York City, which is long gone, of course. He started there in like 68. And then in 1970, he got a crazy idea. He said, hey, let's show movies at midnight, even 1 a.m. And he did that like 7 days a week, like Sunday through Thursday, he showed movies at midnight. Friday and Saturday, he showed them starting at 1 a.m. And he started with a movie I really don't like called Alejandro Jodorowsky's flick El Topo. And it ran and became a big hit. And it ran for 6 months and would have run a lot longer, except John Lennon said, hey, buy the rights to that movie. And he got Alan Klein to buy the rights to the flick and arrange for a proper premiere, you know, just like any other movie. And then it promptly flopped.
Well, you know, I worked for David Lynch on a couple of films and productions, and that's kind of how I know Ben Barinholtz. And when David Lynch was starting out making Eraserhead, he lived with Barinholtz in his apartment.
That's right. For he was not happy with the print that he was getting, and he was working again and again to make sure he got a good quality print on Eraserhead, and he lived at his place until he could get a print he was satisfied with. It was one of the first films that Barinholtz distributed, and David Lynch tells the story that Barinholtz said, hey, David, I'm not going to put any money into this thing because I won't have to. This is what Lynch recalled by phone. He said, I'll open it up at the Cinema Village, and within 2 months, there's going to be lines around the block. And that's what happened, said David Lynch. It's exactly, just put it on there and boom. Eraserhead ran at midnight at the Cinema Village on Friday and Saturday nights for a year. And then for nearly 2 years, also at midnight at the Waverly. Mr. Barinholtz said, it paid my rent for 10 years.
Wow.
So, you know, others immediately jumped on the idea. The Waverly in New York City began showing Night of the Living Dead in 1971. Barinholtz showcased the John Waters flick Pink Flamingos. Then the reggae hit The Harder They Come. And then the Waverly hit the all-time smash with the Rocky Horror Picture Show in 76, which spread the phenomenon of midnight movies all across the country. He championed David Lynch, John Waters, John Sayles. The Coen brothers said the deal that they made with him early in their career, two movies in a row, and then he produced, I think, Miller's Crossing. They said
he produced Miller's Crossing. I know that, having worked on the film.
Yeah, and that his integrity and his fairness and his standards of quality that he delivered on, they said, has never been matched since in their entire career. You know, he was the real deal. So a fascinating, interesting guy.
Well, also a fascinating guy was Martin Charnin, a Tony and Emmy winner for his, well, I guess he's probably best known for Annie, right? The Broadway musical.
Absolutely. He wrote the lyrics and directed the 1977 Broadway musical Annie, one of the biggest hits of all time. But speaking of Stephen Sondheim, he got his break as an actor in the original cast of West Side Story. So, and an orchestrator who won a Tony for West Side Story, the original Broadway show. He just died. I think he was like 100. And Martin Charnin just died. I think he's 84. Was that how old he is? 84, 88, something like that. And he was 84. And, you know, there he goes. West Side Story. He played that role 1,000 times on Broadway and elsewhere. He had no acting experience, but he made the book writer Arthur Lawrence laugh at the audition and somehow got the job as a juvenile delinquent. And even while he was in West Side Story, he was writing lyrics for people's cabaret shows. He was an odd job guy. He would do anything anywhere to get work and keep hustling. He's doing stuff for cabaret, off-Broadway, directing stuff. He worked with Mary Rogers, the daughter of Richard Rogers, and a talented composer in her own right, thanks to Once Upon a Mattress, among others. He went to TV. He won multiple Emmys writing and directing variety shows and specials, including one starring Fred Astaire. I think he directed National Lampoon's Lemmings, an off-Broadway show that helped launch John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Christopher Guest, Harold Ramis, P.J. O'Rourke. Most of those were on stage. Harold Ramis and P.J. O'Rourke were writing, contributing to the book. But there was a vague reference to him and that National Lampoon show, but it didn't name it, and that was all I could track down. So if I'm wrong, please do let me know. But then he hit the jackpot. 1977's Annie. He conceived of the idea. He was always looking for ideas, and he thought, hey, why not turn that comic strip into a musical? He partnered with Charles Strauss, who did the music, and Thomas Meehan, who wrote the book, and Charnin wrote the lyrics and directed. It won 7 Tonys, including Best Musical. It ran for more than 2,300 performances. It was the 8th longest running show in Broadway history when it closed. Right now, it's tied at number 27 on the all-time list. And it's about to be passed by a beautiful and Aladdin, assuming they both run about another 10 weeks.
Well, you know, for his family, who might be quite sad right now, just remember the sun will come out tomorrow.
Oh, don't make a joke about that. That's apparently the story is, as I recall, and it's just probably legend, but it was out of town. They were working on it. They had something was missing. They needed one more hit. And they went upstairs and came back down like 10 minutes later with Tomorrow. You know,
so. Well, all I can say is without my joke, you wouldn't have been able to tell that story, which is the only reason I mentioned it.
Yes. And more sad news. Bossa Nova died this week. Well, not literally Bossa Nova, but performer João Gilberto died at 88.
That is a very good, very good Portuguese. João. Oh, that's exactly.
Thank you very much. Well, Bossa Nova or New Beat or New Trend, that's a combination of the classic Brazilian style samba with jazz. And it took over the world. Antonio Carlos Jobim and many others were there, including singer and guitarist João, who was, you know, really one of the biggest stars ever from that genre. And it still is a vibrant form of music today. It's not a fad, like, say, Hawaiian music was a fad for a while, but its influence faded, whereas Bossa Nova is still beating along even today. He died at 88, unfortunately, with some poor mental health in the last few years, and he fell into hard times financially, which is very sad to hear. I didn't know about that. But it really is an enduring style of music. I mean, there was a period when every singer was required to record a Bossa Nova album. It must have been exhausting and tiresome. Every mom and dad who wanted to be sophisticated slapped on a Bossa Nova album and then started shimmying in the living room. But it survived all that. When you look at some of the great music of all time, Frank Sinatra, one of the greatest singers of all time, maybe his greatest album is his collaboration with Antonio Carlos Jobim, which is called just that, Francis Albert Sinatra and Antonio Carlos Jobim. It's a masterpiece. And then João Gilberto, he partnered with Stan Getz, the great jazz saxophonist. One of the most beautiful sounds in jazz is his saxophone, right there with Lester Young. They did their album, Getz Gilberto, that includes the definitive vision version of The Girl from Ipanema, which was sung by his then wife, Astrid. João's then wife, and Jobim was on piano, and it sold millions of copies. That song,
it is that album is one of the top selling jazz albums of all time.
Oh, absolutely. Not just, that's one of the top selling album, period. I mean, it's a huge monster hit, but yes, absolutely. And that song, The Girl from Ipanema, may be the most recorded song of all time after the Beatles song Yesterday. It won the Grammy for Album of the Year. It's one of only three jazz albums to win, the others being by Ray Charles and Herbie Hancock. And it's the first and only what we might call world music album to win the Grammy for Album of the Year. Most of its lyrics are not in English. So, you know, you might include Paul Simon's Graceland, but that's already a big American pop star. So really, that album, one of the great early picks by the Grammys, and they've never been that smart again. You talk about the Great American Songbook a lot, people who love cabaret and jazz and Broadway and great songs by Rodgers and Hart and all that. You can also talk about the Great World Songbook, and a lot of songs introduced by João Gilberto are on that list. And when you're comparing streaming services, I tell you, Apple does a lot better than Spotify on this guy. Spotify has about 10 albums, including compilations. Apple has about 20, but both of them are missing a lot of music by João. So when you make that jump to a new platform, you really lose a lot of music along the way. They got to keep filling in the gaps with all that great music that's out there that is not available when you go on to Spotify and Apple.
But we are available on iTunes,
sometimes,
Google Play
Store. Sometimes we are. Okay, not fine. Always, so we try.
One time.
One time.
Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, we do ask you to please subscribe to us. That way you won't miss an episode whenever it posts properly. You can also rate and review the show on those aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you rate and review us on any one of those aggregators. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz. Well, every week he's got a new and exciting website. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's bossanovaforever.com.
Which probably does exist. So if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.